And a good thing. Davis gestured at the distant lights flickering along the walls of Storm's End. Feel how cold the wind is. The guards will huddle close to those torches. Little warmth, a little light. They're a comfort on a night like this. Yet, that will blind them, so they will not see us pass. I hope. The God of Darkness protects us now, my lady, even you.
The flames of her eyes seemed to burn a little brighter at that.
Speak not that name, sir, lest you draw his black eye upon us. He protects no man, I promise you. He is the enemy of all that lives. It is the torches that hide us. You have said so yourself. Fire, the bright gift of the Lord of Light.
Have it your way.
His way, rather.
The wind was shifting. Davis could feel it, see it in the way the black canvas rippled. He reached for the halyards.
Help me bring in the sail. I'll row us the rest of the way.
Together they tied off the sail as the boat rocked beneath them. As Davis unshipped the oars and slid them into the choppy black waters, he said,
Who rowed you to Renly?
There was no need, she said. He was unprotected. But here, the Storm's End is an old place. There are spells woven into the stones, dark walls that no shadow can pass, ancient, forgotten, yet still in place.
Shadow? Davis felt his flesh prickling. A shadow is a thing of darkness.
You are more ignorant than a child, Sir Knight. There are no shadows in the dark. Shadows are the servants of light, the children of fire. The brightest flame casts the darkest shadows.
Frowning, Davis hushed her then. They were coming close to shore once more, and voices carried across the water. He rowed, the faint sound of his oars lost in the rhythm of the waves. The seaward side of Storm's End perched upon a pale white cliff, the chalky stone sloping up steeply to half again the height of the massive curtain wall. A mouth yawned in the cliff, and it was that Davis steered for, as he had 16 years before. The tunnel opened on a cavern under the castle, where the Stormlords of old had built their landing. The passage was navigable only during high tide, and it was never less than treacherous. But his smuggler's skills had not deserted him. Davis threaded their way deftly between the jagged rocks until the cave mouth loomed up before them. He let the waves carry them inside. They crashed around him, slamming the boat this way and that, and soaking them to the skin. A half-seen finger of rock came rushing up out of the gloom, snarling foam, and Davis barely kept them off it with an oar. Then they were past, engulfed in darkness, and the waters smoothed. The little boat slowed and swirled. The sound of their breathing echoed until it seemed to surround them. Davis had not expected the blackness. The last time, torches had burned all along the tunnel, and the eyes of starving men had peered down through the murder holes in the ceiling. The portcullis was somewhere ahead, he knew. Davis used the oars to slow them, and they drifted against it almost gently.
This is as far as we go, unless you have a man inside to lift the gate for us.
His whispers scurried across the lapping water like a line of mice on soft pink feet.
Have we passed within the walls?
Yes, beneath, but we can go no farther. The portcullis goes down all the way to the bottom, and the bars are too closely spaced for even a child to squeeze through.
There was no answer, but a soft rustling, and then a light bloomed amidst the darkness. Davis raised a hand to shield his eyes, and his breath caught in his throat. Melisandre had thrown back her cowl and shrugged out of the smothering robe. Beneath, she was naked, and huge with child. Swollen breasts hung heavy against her chest, and her belly bulged as if near to bursting.
God's preserve us,
he whispered.
and heard her answering laugh, deep and throaty. Her eyes were hot coals, and the sweat that dappled her skin seemed to glow with a light of its own. Melisande shone. Panting, she squatted and spread her legs. Blood ran down her thighs, black as ink. Her cry might have been agony, or ecstasy, or both. And Davis saw the crown of the child's head push its way out of her. Two arms wriggled free, grasping, black fingers coiling around Melisande's straining thighs, pushing, until the whole of the shadow slid out into the world and rose taller than Davis, tall as the tunnel, towering above the boat. He had only an instant to look at it before it was gone, twisting between the bars of the portcullis and racing across the surface of the water. But that instant was long enough. He knew that shadow, as he knew the man who'd cast it.
The King's Prize. The King's host departed Deepwood Mott by the light of a golden dawn, uncoiling from behind the log palisades like a long steel serpent emerging from its nest. The southern knights rode out in plate and mail, dinted and scarred by the battles they had fought, but still bright enough to glitter when they caught the rising sun. Faded and stained, torn and mended, their banners and surcoats still made a riot of colours amidst the winter wood. Azure and orange, red and green, purple and blue and gold, glimmering amongst bare brown trunks, grey-green pines and sentinels, drifts of dirty snow. Each knight had his squires, servants, and men-at-arms. Behind them came armourers, cooks, grooms, ranks of spearmen, axemen, archers, grizzled veterans of 100 battles, and green boys off to fight their first. Before them marched the clansmen from the hills, chiefs and champions astride shaggy garrons, their hirsute fighters trotting beside them, clad in furs and boiled leather and old mail. Some painted their faces brown and green and tied bundles of brush about them to hide amongst the trees. Back of the main column, the baggage train followed. Mules, horses, oxen, a mile of wains and carts laden with food, fodder, tents, and other provisions. Last, the rear guard, more knights in plate and mail, with a screening of outriders following half-hidden, to make certain no foe could steal up on them unawares. Asher Greyjoy rode in the baggage train, in a covered wain, with two huge iron-rim wheels, fettered at wrist and ankle, and watched over day and night by a she-bear who snored worse than any man. His Grace King Stannis was taking no chances on his prize escaping captivity. He meant to carry her to Winterfell to display her there in chains for the lords of the North to see. The Kraken's daughter, bound and broken, proof of his power. Trumpet saw the column on its way. Spear points shone in the light of the rising sun, and all along the verges the grass glistened with a morning frost. Between Deepwood Mott and Winterfell lay 100 leagues of forest, 300 miles, as the raven flies. 15 days, the knights told each other. Robert would have done it in 10, Asher heard Lord Fell boasting. His grandsire had been slain by Robert at Summerhall. Somehow this had elevated his slayer to godlike prowess in the grandson's eyes. Robert would have been inside Winterfell a fortnight ago, thumbing his nose at Bolton from the battlements. Best not mention that to Stannis, suggested Justin Massey, or he'll have us marching nights as well as days. This king lives in his brother's shadow, Asher thought. Her ankle still gave a stab of pain whenever she tried to put her weight on it. Something was broken down inside, Asher did not doubt. The swelling had gone down at Deepwood, but the pain remained. A sprain would surely have healed by now. Her arms clacked every time she moved. The fetters chafed at her wrist and at her pride. But that was the cost of submission.
"No man has ever died from bending his knee," her father had once told her. "He who kneels may rise again, bleed in hand. He who will not kneel stays dead, stiff legs and all."
Balin Greyjoy had proved the truth of his own words when his first rebellion failed. The kraken bent the knee to stag and direwolf, only to rise again when Robert Baratheon and Eddard Stark were dead. And so, at Deepwood, the kraken's daughter had done the same when she was dumped before the king, bound and limping, though blessedly unraped, her ankle a blaze of pain.
"I yield, your grace. Do as you wish with me. I ask only that you spare my men."
Carl and Triss and the rest who had survived the Wolf's Wood were all she had to care about. Only 9 remained.
"We ragged 9,
Crumb named them. He was the worst wounded. Stannis had given her their lives, yet she sensed no true mercy in the man. He was determined beyond a doubt, nor did he lack for courage. Men said he was just, and if his was a harsh, hard-handed sort of justice, well, life on the Iron Islands had accustomed Asher Greyjoy to that. All the same, she could not like this king. Those deep-set blue eyes of his seemed always slitted in suspicion, cold fury boiling just below their surface. Her life meant little and less to him. She was only his hostage, a prize to show the North that he could vanquish the Ironborn. More fool him. Bringing down a woman was not like to awe any Northman, if she knew the breed, and her worth as a hostage was less than naught. Her uncle ruled the Iron Islands now, and the Crow's Eye would not care if she lived or died. It might matter some to the wretched ruin of a husband that Euron had inflicted upon her, but Eric Ironmaker did not have coin enough to ransom her. But there was no explaining such things to Stannis Baratheon. Her very womanhood seemed to offend him. Men from the Greenlands liked their women soft and sweet in silk, she knew, not clad in mail and leather, with a throwing axe in each hand. But her short acquaintance with the king at Deepwood Mott convinced her that he would have been no more fond of her in a gown. Even with Gorbert Glover's wife, the pious Lady Sibel, he had been correct and courteous, but plainly uncomfortable. This southern king seemed to be one of those men to whom women are another race, as strange and unfathomable as giants and grumpkins and the children of the forest. The she-bear made him grind his teeth as well. There was only one woman that Stannis listened to, and he had left her on the wall.
"Though I would sooner she was with us," confessed Sir Justin Massey, the fair-haired knight who commanded the baggage train. "The last time we went into battle without Lady Melisandre was the Blackwater, when Lord Renly's Shade came down upon us and drove half our host into the bay." "The last time," Asher said, "was this sorceress at Deepwood Mott? I did not see her."
"Hardly a battle," Sir Justin said, smiling.
"Your iron men fought bravely, my lady, but we had many times your numbers, and we took you unawares. Winterfell will know that we are coming, and Roose Bolton has as many men as we do."
"Or more," thought Asher. Even prisoners have ears, and she had heard all the talk at Deepwood Mott when King Stannis and his captains were debating this march. Sir Justin had opposed it from the start, along with many of the knights and lords who had come with Stannis from the south. But the wolves insisted. Roose Bolton could not be suffered to hold Winterfell.
and the Ned's girl must be rescued from the clutches of his bastard. So said Morgan Little, Brandon Norrie, Big Bucket Wall, the Flints, even the She-Bear.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, said Artus Flint, the night the argument boiled to a head in Gorbert Glover's Longhorn. 300 miles as raven flies.
A long march, a knight named Corlys Penny said.
Not so long as that, insisted Sir Godfrey, the big knight, the others called the Giant Slayer. We have come as far already. The Lord of Light will blaze a path for us.
And when we arrive before Winterfell, said Justin Massey, 2 walls with a moat between them, and the inner wall 100 feet high. Bolton will never march out to face us in the field, and we do not have the provisions to mount a siege.
Arne of Carstock will join his strength to ours, never forget, said Harwood Fell.
Moore's Umber as well. We will have as many Northmen as Lord Bolton, and the woods are thick north of the castle. We will raise siege towers, build rams.
And die by the thousands, Asher thought.
We might do best to winter here, suggested Lord Peasbury.
Winter here? Big Bucket roared. How much food and fodder do you think Gorbert Glover has laid by?
Then Sir Richard Hope, the knight with a ravaged face and the death's head muffs on his surcoat, turned to Stannis and said,
Your Grace, your brother.
The king cut him off. We all know what my brother would do. Robert would gallop up to the gates of Winterfell alone, break them with his war hammer, and ride through the rubble to slay Roose Bolton with his left hand and the bastard with his right. Stannis rose to his feet. I am not Robert. But we will march, and we will free Winterfell, or die in the attempt. Whatever doubts his lords might nurse, the common men seemed to have faith in their king. Stannis had smashed Mance Raider's wildlings at the wall, and cleaned Asher and her ironborn out of Deepwood Mott. He was Robert's brother, victor in a famous sea battle or Fair Isle, the man who had held Storm's End all through Robert's rebellion. And he bore a hero's sword, the enchanted blade Lightbringer, whose glow lit up the night.
Our foes are not as formidable as they appear, Sir Justin assured Asher on the first day of the march. Roose Bolton is feared but little loved, and his friends, the Freys, the North has not forgotten the Red Wedding. Every lord at Winterfell lost kinsmen there. Stannis need only bloody Bolton, and the Northmen will abandon him.
So you hope, thought Asher. But first the king must bloody him. Only a fool deserts the winning side.
Sir Justin called upon her cart 6 times that first day to bring her food and drink and tidings of the march. A man of easy smiles and endless japes, large and well-fleshed, with pink cheeks, blue eyes, and a wind-tussed tangle of white blonde hair as pale as flax. He was a considerate jailer, ever solicitous of his captive's comfort.
"He wants you," said the She-Bear, after his third visit.
Her proper name was Alisane of House Mormont, but she wore the other name as easily as she wore her mail, short, chunky, muscular. The heir to Bear Island had big thighs, big breasts, and big hands ridged with callus. Even in sleep, she wore ringmail under her furs, boiled leather under that, and an old sheepskin under the leather, turned inside out for warmth. All those layers made her look almost as wide as she was tall.
And ferocious.
Sometimes it was hard for Asher Greyjoy to remember that she and the She-Bear were almost of an age.
"He wants my lands," Asher replied. "He wants the Iron Islands."
She knew the signs. She had seen the same before in other suitors. Massey's own ancestral holdings, far to the south, were lost to him. so he must needs make an advantageous marriage or resign himself to being no more than a knight of the king's household. Stannis had frustrated Sir Justin's hopes of marrying the wildling princess that Asher had heard so much of, so now he had set his sights on her. No doubt he dreamed of putting her in the sea stone chair on Pike and ruling through her as her lord and master. That would require ridding her of her present lord and master, to be sure, not to mention the uncle who had married her to him.
Not likely, Asher judged. The crow's eye could eat Sir Justin to break his fast, and never even belch.
It made no matter. Her father's lands would never be hers, no matter whom she married. The Ironborn were not a forgiving people, and Asher had been defeated twice. Once at the King's Moot by her uncle Euron, and again at Deepwood Mott by Stannis. More than enough to stamp her as unfit to rule. Wedding Justin Massey, or any of Stannis Baratheon's lordlings, would hurt more than it helped.
The Kraken's daughter turned out to be just a woman after all,
the captains and the kings would say.
See how she spreads her legs for this self-green landlord.
Still, if Sir Justin wished to court her favour with food and wine and words, Asher was not like to discourage him. He made for better company than the taciturn she-bear, and she was elsewise alone amongst 5,000 foes. Triss Botley, Carl the Maid, Crum, Rogan, and the rest of her blooded band had been left behind at Deepwood Mott in Gorbert Glover's dungeons. The army covered 22 miles the first day, by the reckoning of the guides Lady Sibel had given them, trackers and hunters sworn to Deepwood with clan names like Forrester and Woods, Branch and Bowl. The second day the host made 24, as their vanguard passed beyond the Glover lands into the thick of the Wolfswood.
R'hllor, send your light to lead us through this gloom.
The faithful prayed that night as they gathered about a roaring blaze outside the king's pavilion. Southern knights and men-at-arms, the lot of them. Asher would have called them kingsmen, but the other Stormlanders and Crownland's men named them queensmen, though the queen they followed was the Red One at Castle Black, not the wife that Stannis Baratheon had left behind at Eastwatch by the Sea. O Lord of Light, we beseech you, cast your fiery eye upon us and keep us safe and warm, they sang to the flames, for the night is dark and full of terrors. A big knight named Sir Godfrey Fearing led them.
Godfrey the Giant Slayer, a big name for a small man.
Fearing was broad-chested and well-muscled under his plate and mail. He was also arrogant and vain, it seemed to Asher, hungry for glory, deaf to caution, a glutton for praise, and contemptuous of small folk, wolves, and women. In the last, he was not unlike his king.
"Let me have a horse," Asher asked Sir Justin, when he rode up to the wain with half a ham. "I'm going mad in these chains. I will not attempt escape. You have my word on that."
"Would that I could, my lady. You are the king's captive, not mine own."
"Your king will not take a woman's word,"
the she-bear growled.
"Why should we trust the word of any iron man after what your brother did at Winterfell?"
"I am not Theon,"
Asher insisted, but the chains remained. As Sir Justin galloped down the column, she found herself remembering the last time she had seen her mother. It had been on Harlaw, at 10 Towers. A candle had been flickering in her mother's chamber, but her great carved bed was empty beneath its dusty canopy. Lady Alanis sat beside a window, staring out across the sea.
"Did you bring my baby boy?"
she'd asked, mouth trembling. Theon could not come,
Asha had told her, looking down upon the ruin of the woman who had given her birth, a mother who had lost two of her sons, and a third.
I send you each a piece of prince.
Whatever befell when battle was joined at Winterfell, Asha Greyjoy did not think her brother likely to survive it.
Theon Turncloak, even the she-bear, wants his head on a spake. Do you have brothers?
Asha asked her keeper.
Sisters, Alisane Mormont replied, gruff as ever. Five we were, all girls. Lyanna is back on Bear Island. Lyra and Jory are with our mother. Daisy was murdered.
The Red Wedding?
Aye. Alisane stared at Asha for a moment. I have a son. He's only two. My daughter's nine.
You started young.
Too young, but better that than wait too late.
A stab at me, Asha thought. But let it be. You are wed.
No, my children were fathered by a bear.
Alison smiled. Her teeth were crooked, but there was something ingratiating about that smile.
Mormont women are skin changers. We turn into bears and find mates in the woods. Everyone knows.
Asha smiled back. Mormont women are all fighters, too.
The other woman's smile faded.
What we are is what you made us. On Bear Island, every child learns to fear krakens rising from the sea.
The old way.
Asha turned away, chains clinking faintly. On the third day, the forest pressed close around them, and the rutted roads dwindled down to game trails that soon proved to be too narrow for their larger wagons. Here and there they wound their way past familiar landmarks, a stony hill that looked a bit like a wolf's head when seen from a certain angle, a half-frozen waterfall, a natural stone arch bearded with grey-green moss. Asha knew them all. She had come this way before, riding to Winterfell to persuade her brother Theon to abandon his conquest and return with her to the safety of Deepwood Mott.
I failed in that as well.
That day they made 14 miles and were glad of it. When dusk fell, the driver pulled the wain off under the tree. As he was loosing the horses from the traces, Sir Justin trotted up and undid the fetters around Asher's ankles. He and the she-bear escorted her through the camp to the king's tent. A captive she might be, but she was still a Greyjoy of Pike, and it pierced Sannis Baratheon to feed her scraps from his own table, where he supped with his captains and commanders. The king's pavilion was near as large as the long hall back at Deepwood Mott, but there was little grand about it beyond its size. Its stiff walls of heavy yellow canvas were badly faded, stained by mud and water, with spots of mildew showing. Atop its centre pole flew the royal standard, golden, with a stag's head within a burning heart. On three sides the pavilions of the southern lordlings, who had come north with Stannis, surrounded it. On the fourth side the night fire roared, lashing at the darkening sky with swirls of flame. A dozen men were splitting lugs to feed the blaze when Asha came limping up with her keepers.
Queen's men.
Their guard was Red R'hllor, and a jealous guard he was. Her own guard, the drowned guard of the Iron Isles, was a demon to their eyes. And if she did not embrace this Lord of Light, she would be damned and doomed.
They would as gladly burn me as those logs and broken branches.
Some had urged that very thing within her hearing after the battle in the woods. Stannis had refused. The king stood outside his tent, staring into the night fire.
What does he see there? Victory? Doom? The face of his red and hungry god?
His eyes were sunk in deep pits, his close-cropped beard no more than a shadow across his hollow cheeks and bony jawbone. Yet there was power in his stare, an iron ferocity that told Asher this man would never, ever turn back from his course. She went to one knee before him.
"Sire, am I humbled enough for you, your grace? Am I beaten, bowed, and broken sufficiently for your liking? Strike these chains from my wrists. I beg you, let me ride. I will attempt no escape."
Stannis looked at her as he might look at a dog who presumed to hump against his leg. "You earned those irons."
"I did. Now I offer you my men, my ships, my wits."
"Your ships are mine, or burnt. Your men, how many are left? 10, 12?
9, 6, if you count only those strong enough to fight. Dagmar Cleftjaw holds Turin Square, a fierce fighter and a leal servant of House Greyjoy. I can deliver that castle to you and its garrison as well."
"Perhaps," she might have added, but it would not serve her cause to show doubt before this king. "Torrion Square is not worth a mud beneath my heels. It is Winterfell that matters."
"Strike off these irons and let me help you take it, sire. Your grace's royal brother was renowned for turning fallen foes into friends. Make me your man."
"The gods did not make you a man. How can I?" Stannis turned back to the Nightfire, and whatever he saw dancing there amongst the orange flames. Sir Justin Massey grasped Asher by the arm and pulled her inside the royal tent.
"That was ill-judged, my lady," he told her. "Never speak to him of Robert."
"I should have known better." Asher knew how it went with little brothers. She remembered Theon as a boy, a shy child who lived in awe and fear of Roderick and Maron.
"They never grow out of it," she decided. "A little brother may live to be 100, but he will always be a little brother."
She rattled her iron jewelry, and imagined how pleasant it would be to step up behind Stannis and throttle him with the chain that bound her wrists. They supped that night on a venison stew, made from a scrawny heart that a scout called Benjicot Branch had brought down. But only in the royal tent. Beyond those canvas walls, each man got a heel of bread and a chunk of black sausage no longer than a finger, washed down with the last of Gorbert Glover's ale. 100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell. 300 miles as the raven flies. "Would that we were ravens," Justin Massey said, on the fourth day of the march, the day the snow began to fall. Only a few small flurries at first, cold and wet, but nothing they could not push through easily. But it snowed again, the next day, and the day after, and the day after that. The thick beards of the wolves were soon caked with ice, where their breath had frozen, and every clean-shaven southern boy was letting his whiskers grow out to keep his face warm. Before long, the ground ahead of the column was blanketed in white, concealing stones and twisted roots and deadfalls, turning every step into an adventure. The wind picked up as well, driving the snow before it. The king's host became a column of snowmen, staggering through knee-high drifts. On the third day of snow, the king's host began to come apart. Whilst the southern knights and lordlings struggled, the men of the northern hills fared better. Their garrons were sure-footed beasts that ate less than the palfreys, and much less than the big destriers, and the men who rode them were at home in the snow. Many of the wolves donned curious footwear. Bear paws, they call them. Queer elongated things made with bent wood and leather strips. Lashed onto the bottoms of their boots, the things somehow allowed them to walk on top of the snow without breaking through the crust and sinking down to their thighs. Some had bear paws for their horses, too, and the shaggy little Garrons wore them as easily as other mounts wore iron horseshoes. But the palfreys and destriers wanted no part of them. When a few of the king's knights strapped them onto their feet nonetheless, the big southern horses balked and refused to move, or tried to shake the things off their feet. One destrier broke an ankle, trying to walk in them. The Northmen, on their bare paws, soon began to outdistance the rest of the host. They overtook the knights in the main column, then Sir Godfrey Fairing and his vanguard, and meanwhile the wains and wagons of the baggage train were falling farther and farther behind, so much so that the men of the rear guard were constantly chivying them to keep up a faster pace. On the fifth day of the storm, the baggage train crossed a rippling expanse of waist-high snowdrifts that concealed a frozen pond. When the hidden ice cracked beneath the weight of the wagons, three teamsters and four horses were swallowed up by the freezing water, along with two of the men who tried to rescue them. One was Harwood Fell. His knights pulled him out before he drowned, but not before his lips turned blue and his skin as pale as milk. Nothing they did could seem to warm him afterwards. He shivered violently for hours, even when they cut him out of his sodden clothes, wrapped him in warm furs, and set him by the fire. That same night, he slipped into a feverish sleep. He never woke. That was the night that Asher first heard the Queen's men muttering about a sacrifice, an offering to their Red Guard, so he might end the storm. "The guards of the North have unleashed this storm on us," Sir Corlys Penny said. "False gods," insisted Sir Godfrey, the giant slayer. "Rilor is with us," said Sir Clayton Suggs.
"Melisandre is not," said Justin Massey.
The king said nothing, but he heard. Asher was certain of that. He sat at the high table as a dish of onion soup cooled before him, hardly tasted, staring at the flame of the nearest candle with those hooded eyes, ignoring the talk around him. The second in command, the lean, tall knight named Richard Horp, spoke for him.
"The storm must break soon," he declared.
But the storm only worsened. The wind became a lash as cruel as any slaver's whip. Asher thought she had known cold on Pike when the wind came howling off the sea, but that was nothing compared to this.
"This is a cold that drives men mad."
Even when the shout came down the line to make camp for the night, it was no easy thing to warm yourself. The tents were damp and heavy, hard to raise, harder to take down, and prone to sudden collapse if too much snow accumulated on top of them. The king's host was creeping through the heart of the largest forest in the Seven Kingdoms. Yet dry wood became difficult to find. Every camp saw fewer fires burning, and those that were lit threw off more smoke than heat. Oft as not, food was eaten cold, even raw. Even the night fire shrank and grew feeble, to the dismay of the Queen's men.
"Lord of Light, preserve us from this evil," they prayed, led by the deep voice of Sir Godfrey the Giant Slayer. "Show us your bright sun again. Still these winds and melt these snows, that we may reach your foes and smite them. The night is dark and cold and full of terrors, but yours is the power and glory and the light. Rilor, fill us with your fire."
Later, when Sir Corlys Penny wondered aloud whether an entire army had ever frozen to death in a winter storm, the wolves laughed.
"This is no winter," declared Big Bucket Wall. "Up in the hills, we say that autumn kisses you, but winter fucks you hard. This is only autumn's kiss."
God grant that I never know true winter then.
Asher herself was spared the worst of it. She was the king's prize, after all. Whilst others hungered, she was fed. Whilst others shivered, she was warm. Whilst others struggled through the snows atop weary horses, she rode upon a bed of furs inside a wain, with a stiff canvas roof to keep the snow off, comfortable in her chains. The horses and the common men had it hardest. Two squires from the Stormlands stabbed a man-at-arms to death in a quarrel over who would sit closest to the fire. The next night, some archers, desperate for warmth, somehow managed to set their tent afire, which had at least the virtue of heating the adjacent tents. Destriers began to perish of exhaustion and exposure. "What is a knight without a horse?" men riddled. "A snowman with a sword." Any horse that went down was butchered on the spot for meat. Their provisions had begun to run low as well. Peasbury, Cobb, Foxglove, and other southern lords urged the king to make camp until the storm had passed. Stannis would have none of that. Nor would he heed the queen's men when they came to urge him to make an offering to their hungry red god. That tale she had from Justin Massey, who was less devout than most.
"A sacrifice will prove our faith still burns true, sire,"
Clayton Suggs had told the king. And Gudry, the giant slayer, said, "The old gods of the north have sent this storm upon us. Only R'hllor can end it. We must give him an unbeliever." "Half my army is made up of unbelievers," Stannis had replied. "I will have no burnings. Pray harder."
"No burnings today and none tomorrow. But if the snows continue, how long before the king's resolve begins to weaken?"
Asher had never shared her uncle Aaron's faith in the drowned god. But that night she prayed as fervently to he who dwells beneath the waves as ever the damp hair had. The storm did not abate. The march continued, slowing to a stagger, then a crawl. 5 miles was a good day, then 3, then 2. By the 9th day of the storm, every camp saw the captains and commanders entering the king's tent, wet and weary, to sink to one knee and report their losses for the day.
"One man dead, 3 missing. 6 horses lost, one of them mine own. 2 dead men, 1 a knight. 4 horses down. We got one up again. The others are lost. Destriers and 1 palfrey."
The Cold Count, Asher heard it named. The baggage train suffered the worst. Dead horses, lost men, wains overturned and broken. "The horses founder in the snow," Justin Massey told the king. "Men wander off or just sit down to die."
"Let them," King Stannis snapped. "We press on."
The Northmen fared much better, with their garrons and their bear paws. Black Donald Flint and his half-brother Artus only lost 1 man between them. The Liddles, the Walls, and the Norries lost none at all. One of Morgan Liddell's mules had gone astray, but he seemed to think the Flints had stolen him.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, 300 miles as a raven flies, 15 days.
The 15th day of the march came and went, and they had crossed less than half the distance. A trail of broken wains and frozen corpses stretched back behind them, buried beneath the blowing snow. The sun and moon and stars had been gone so long that Asher was starting to wonder whether she had dreamed them. It was the 20th day of the advance when she finally won free of her ankle chains. Late that afternoon, one of the horses drawing her wain died in the traces. No replacement could be found. What draft horses remained were needed to pull the wagons that held their food and fodder.
When Sir Justin Massey rode up, he told them to butcher the dead horse for meat and break up the wagon for firewood. Then he removed the fetters from around Asher's ankles, rubbing the stiffness from her calves.
"I have no mount to give you, my lady," he said, "and if we tried to ride double, it would be the end of my horse as well. You must walk."
Asher's ankle throbbed beneath her weight with every step. "The cold will numb it soon enough," she told herself. "In an hour I won't feel my feet at all." She was only part wrong. It took less time than that. By the time darkness halted the column, she was stumbling and yearning for the comforts of her rolling prison.
"The irons made me weak."
Supper found her so exhausted that she fell asleep at the table. On the 26th day of the 15-day march, the last of the vegetables was consumed. On the 32nd day, the last of the grain and fodder. Asher wondered how long a man could live on raw, half-frozen horse meat.
"Branch swears we're only 3 days from Winterfell," Sir Richard Hope told the king that night after the cold count. "If we leave the weakest men behind," said Corliss Penny. "The weakest men are beyond saving," insisted Hope. "Those still strong enough must reach Winterfell, or die as well."
"The Lord of Light will deliver us the castle," said Sir Godfrey Fairing, "if Lady Melisandre were with us."
Finally, after a nightmarish day, when the column advanced a bare mile and lost 12 horses and 4 men, Lord Peasbury turned against the Northmen.
"This march was madness. More dying every day, and for what? Some girl?"
"Ned's girl," said Morgan Little. He was the second of 3 sons, so the other wolves called him Middle Little, though not often in his hearing. It was Morgan who had almost slain Asher in the fight by Deepwood Mott. He had come to her later, on the march, to beg her pardon for calling her cunt in his battle lust, not for trying to split her head open with an axe.
"Ned's girl," echoed Big Bucket Wool. "And we should have had her and the castle both, if you prancing Southland jackanapes didn't piss your satin breeches at Little Snow."
"A little snow?" Peasbury's soft, girlish mouth twisted in fury. "Your ill counsel forced this march upon us, well. I am starting to suspect that you have been Bolton's creature all along. Is that the way of it? Did he send you to us to whisper poison in the king's ear?" Big Bucket laughed in his face.
"Lord Peabod, if you were a man, I would kill you for that. But my sword is made of too fine a steel to besmirch with craven's blood."
He took a drink of ale and wiped his mouth.
"Aye, men are dying. More will die before we see Winterfell. What of it? This is war. Men die in war. That is as it should be, as it has always been."
Sir Corliss Penny gave the clan chief an incredulous look.
"Do you want to die, Wall?"
That seemed to amuse the Northman.
"I want to live forever, in a land where summer lasts 1,000 years. I want a castle in the clouds, where I can look down over the world. I want to be 26 again. When I was 26, I could fight all day and fuck all night. What men want does not matter. Winter is almost upon us, boy, and winter is death. I would sooner my men die fighting
for the Ned's little girl
than alone and hungry in the snow, weeping tears that freeze upon their cheeks. No one sings songs of men who die like that. As for me, I'm old. This will be my last winter. Let me bathe in Bolton blood before I die. I want to feel it spatter across my face when my axe bites deep into a Bolton skull. I want to lick it off my lips and die with the taste of it on my tongue."
"Aye," shouted Morgan Little,
Blood and battle! Then all the hillmen were shouting, banging their cups and drinking horns on the table, filling the king's tent with the clangor. Asher Greyjoy would have welcomed a fight herself.
One battle to put an end to this misery. Steel on steel, pink snow, broken shields, and severed limbs, and it would all be done.
The next day the king's scouts chanced upon an abandoned crofter's village between two lakes, a mean and meagre place, no more than a few huts, a long hall, and a watchtower. Richard Hope commanded a halt, though the army had advanced no more than a half mile that day, and they were hours shy of dark. It was well past moonrise before the baggage train and rear guard straggled in. Asher was amongst them.
"There are fish in those lakes," Hope told the king. "We'll cut holes in the ice. The Northmen know how it's done."
Even in his bulky fur cloak and heavy armour, Stannis looked like a man with one foot in the grave. What little flesh he'd carried on his tall, spare frame at Deepwood Mott had melted away during the march. The shape of his skull could be seen under his skin, and his jaw was clenched so hard Asher feared his teeth might shatter. "Fish, then," he said, biting off each word with a snap. "But we march at first light." Yet when light came, the camp woke to snow and silence. The sky turned from black to white and seemed no brighter. Asher Greyjoy awoke cramped and cold beneath the pile of sleeping furs, listening to the she-bear snores. She had never known a woman snore so loudly, but she had grown used to it whilst on the march, and even took some comfort in it now. It was the silence that troubled her. No trumpets blew to rouse the men to mount up, form column, prepare to march. No war horns summoned forth the Northmen. "Something is wrong." Asher crawled out from under her sleeping furs and pushed her way out of the tent, knocking aside the wall of snow that had sealed them in during the night. Her irons clanked as she climbed to her feet and took a breath of the icy morning air. The snow was still falling, even more heavily than when she had crawled inside the tent. The lakes had vanished, and the woods as well. She could see the shapes of other tents and lean-tos and the fuzzy orange glow of the beacon fire burning atop the watchtower, but not the tower itself. The storm had swallowed the rest. Somewhere ahead, Roose Bolton awaited them, behind the walls of Winterfell. But Stannis Baratheon's host sat snowbound and unmoving, walled in by ice and snow, starving.
Tyrion. They had taken shelter beneath the copse of aspens just off the high road. Tyrion was gathering dead wood while their horses took water from a mountain stream. He stooped to pick up a splintered branch and examined it critically.
"Will this do? I am not practised at starting fires. Morric did that for me."
"A fire?" Bronn said, spitting. "Are you so hungry to die, dwarf? Have you taken leave of your senses? A fire will bring the clansmen down on us for miles around. I mean to survive this journey, Lannister."
"And how do you hope to do that?"
Tyrion asked. He tucked the branch under his arm and poked around through the sparse undergrowth looking for more. His back ached from the effort of bending. They had been riding since daybreak, when a stone-faced Selin Corbray had ushered them through the bloody gate and commanded them never to return.
"We have no chance of fighting our way back," Bronn said. "But two can cover more ground than ten and attract less notice. The fewer days we spend in these mountains, the more likely we are to reach the Riverlands. Ride hard and fast, I say. Travel by night and hole up by day. Avoid the road where we can. make no noise and light no fires."
Tyrion Lannister sighed.
"A splendid plan, Bronn. Try it, as you like, and forgive me if I do not linger to bury you."
"You think to outlive me, dwarf?"
the sellsword grinned. He had a dark gap in his smile where the edge of Savara's Egan shield had cracked a tooth in half. Tyrion shrugged.
"Riding hard and fast by night is a sure way to tumble down a mountain and crack your skull. I prefer to make my crossing slow and easy. I know you love the taste of horse, Bronn, but if our mounts die under us this time, we'll be trying to saddle shadow cats. And if truth be told, I think the clans will find us no matter what we do. Their eyes are all around us."
He swept a gloved hand over the high, wind-carved crags that surrounded them. Bronn grimaced.
"Then we're dead men, Lannister."
"If so, I prefer to die comfortable," Tyrion replied. "We need a fire. The nights are cold up here, and hot food will warm our bellies and lift our spirits. Do you suppose there's any game to be had? Lady Lysa has kindly provided us with a veritable feast of salt beef, hard cheese, and stale bread. But I would hate to break a tooth so far from the nearest maester."
"I can find meat."
Beneath a fall of black hair, Bronn's dark eyes regarded Tyrion suspiciously.
"I should leave you here with your fool's fire. If I took your horse, I'd have twice the chance to make it through. What would you do then, dwarf?"
"Die, most like."
Tyrion stooped to get another stick.
"You don't think I'd do it?"
"Oh, you'd do it in an instant if it meant your life. You were quick enough to silence your friend Shigan when he caught that arrow in his belly."
Bronn had yanked back the man's head by the hair and driven the point of his dirk in under the ear, and afterward told Catelyn Stark that the other sellsword had died of his wound.
"He was as good as dead," Bronn said, "and his moaning was bringing them down on us. Chicken would have done the same for me, and he was no friend, only a man I rode with. Make no mistake, dwarf, I fought for you, but I do not love you."
"It was your blade I needed," Tyrion said, "not your love."
He dumped his armful of wood on the ground. Bronn grinned.
"You're bold as any sellsword, I'll give you that. How did you know I'd take your part?"
"No."
Tyrion squatted awkwardly on his stunted legs to build the fire.
"I tossed the dice. Back at the inn, you and Chicken helped take me captive. Why? The others saw it as their duty, for the honour of the lords they serve, but not you two. You had no lord, no duty, and a precious little honour. So why trouble to involve yourselves?"
He took out his knife and whittled some thin strips of bark off one of the sticks he'd gathered to serve as kindling.
"Well, why do sellswords do anything?" "For gold. You were thinking Lady Catelyn would reward you for your help, perhaps even take you into her service. Here, that should do, I hope. Do you have a flint?"
Bronn slid two fingers into the pouch at his belt and tossed down a flint. Tyrion caught it in the air.
"My thanks," he said. "The thing is, you did not know the Starks. Lord Eddard is a proud, honourable, and honest man, and his lady wife is worse. Oh, no doubt she would have found a coin or two for you when this was all over, and pressed it in your hand with a polite word and a look of distaste. But that's the most you could hope for. The Starks look for courage and loyalty and honour in the men they choose to serve them. And if truth be told, you and Chicken were low-born scum."
Tyrion struck the flint against his dagger, trying for a spark. Nothing. Bronn snorted.
"You have a bold tongue, little man. One day someone is like to cut it out and make you eat it."
"Everyone tells me that."
Tyrion glanced up at the sellsword.
"Did I offend you? Oh, my pardons. But you are scum, Bronn. Make no mistake. Duty, honour, friendship, what's that to you?"
"No,
Don't trouble yourself. We both know the answer. Still, you're not stupid. Once we reach the Vale...